Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpoff, and I'm really excited and thrilled to have with me today Dr. Marcos Vidal-Mello, who is a professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. He's the Hellman Chair of Anesthesia Research and the head of a really exciting lab doing really interesting functional lung imaging and research, and just recently awarded a big grant to do a 14-site study looking at a bundle to reduce postoperative pulmonary complications. He also recently published, he was the senior author and corresponding author on a really interesting piece talking about driving pressure and transpulmonary pressure, and that is what we're going to talk about today. Some concepts you probably are hearing a lot about and may not fully understand, and I am sure that Dr. Vidal-Mello can explain them to us, and so I want to welcome him to the show. Marcos, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Jed, for the introduction. It's great to be here, and an honor to chat with you and chat with all your listeners.
Fantastic. And I will say that those listeners, regular listeners, will know that anesthesiologynews.com likes to feature some of our shows, and they are going to feature this episode, so you can go over there and check it out and see a link to this episode, and also check out their new podcast called The Etherist, which is actually really great. They're looking at the drug shortage crisis in the United States and what might be causing it, and examining some case studies in some of those drugs and what's happening due to those drug shortages. So check that out as well. All right. So, Marcos, let's jump in. And let me ask you, hopefully our listeners know, but in case they don't, just explain for us, what is driving pressure? What does that mean? What does that, would that term mean?
Okay, so driving pressure is something you have every day when you do mechanical ventilation of your patients. And it is essentially, by definition, the plateau pressure subtracted from the PEEP. Now, there are two main kinds of mechanical ventilation modes, volume-controlled mode and pressure-controlled mode. In the volume-controlled mode, usually there is an inspiratory pause. And so you would like to see that perfect plateau following the peak pressure and subtract that plateau from the peak to have your measurement of plateau pressure. While in the pressure controlled mode, that value will go up to the pressure that's set and usually to stabilize there. And that pressure subtracted from the peak will be the corresponding plateau pressure.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think a lot of people don't realize that, that you can get a plateau pressure on pressure control ventilation. You just don't have to do an inspiratory pause.
Correct. And on the flip side, also the attention to the fact that in particularly in patients with, say, bronchoconstriction or some type of airway disease, that the plateau may not stabilize in the usual, for instance, 10% default of some anesthesia machines. And as a consequence, the plateau in a volume-controlled mode could somewhat overestimate the true plateau of the patient. And in that case, if one would really want to have a good measurement of the plateau, one would have to extend the pause in some way so that that equilibration measurement would be more reliable. And essentially, just to give the concept, is that we are trying to do is to have a plateau measurement that is really representative of the pressures that are acting in the alveoli and not that are acting in the airway.
Right. And I think that's really key. So I always remember thinking of it when I was learning this as, you know, if you have very reactive, constricted airways, so for example, in an asthma attack, that the pressure to push air through those airways will be high. But once it's in and it doesn't have to travel through those airways anymore, then what you're seeing that will be a lower pressure that's reflecting the pressure in the alveoli because you no longer are dealing with those constricted airways because nothing's moving through them.
Exactly.
Great. All right. So that's the difference between a peak pressure, which is whatever the highest pressure is as you're trying to move air in, which is could easily be high due to the bronchoconstriction or the airway disease, as you said, and the plateau, which if you wait long enough is going to take all of that out of the picture and just be due to the alveolar pressure. Okay. So to get the driving pressure, you said we subtract PEEP from that plateau. And that gives us driving pressure. And why PEEP? What role does PEEP play? Why don't we just use the plateau? Why do we need to subtract PEEP?
Well, then essentially what we are trying to do is to have the operating pressure that is acting in the respiratory system, right? So the plateau gives us the total amount of the pressure that's being delivered by the ventilator, while the PEEP is giving essentially the pressure that's applied at the mechanical ventilator at the end of the exhalation, as you know. So that essentially it's the concept of driving, right? Is the driving pressure for the ventilation. So the driving goes from the PEEP to the plateau, while the plateau by itself is the absolute number above atmospheric pressure that's being applied by the ventilator.
Perfect. All right. So, you know, if my plateau pressure is 15 and my PEEP is 5, therefore my driving pressure is 10, and I then go up to 10 on my PEEP, so that now my plateau pressure should go up by 5 as well, and won't my driving pressure go up by the same amount? So that, tell me why that's not necessarily true.
Well, yeah, so that is the point there, right? And if one would think about the pressure volume curve of the respiratory system or of the lungs, and if you guys go back to your physiology days, you will remember that has somewhat of a sigmoid shape. And actually, there will be a sigmoid shape that will be different from the inhalation or the distension of the lung from a completely empty state to a completely full state, and then from the re-emptying of the lung from the full state back to the empty state. And there will be a space between one and the other, which is called the hysteresis of the respiratory system and of the lung. And the fact that that curve is not a line, in a kind of a sigmoid for a first approximation, shows is that the compliance, both of the respiratory system and of the lungs, it changes depending on the level of distension of that system. And as a consequence, for the same magnitude of changing pressure or the same magnitude of changing volume, given that that is not a line, those changes are not going to be directly proportional continuously. So depending on the stage your specific patient is along that curve, if you give a change in 10 centimeters of water pressure, you can have the same or more or less change in volume depending on that position on the pressure volume curve.
Right. So that's really interesting and key, that it's not linear. I kind of also conceptualize it as, and this may or may not be right, so you tell me, but that, you know, if you increase the PEEP, and by doing that, you actually open up additional alveoli that were not open, that then you've got more, for lack of a better word, you've got more space to put volume, and so your plateau, your driving pressure won't go up by as much as your PEEP went up.
By the same proportion. Correct. And that comes even in current applications to the optimization of PEEP, for instance, right? But yeah, so going exactly to this point, if say now that we are talking about going up on PEEP, right? And so if you go up with PEEP, and then you say that you're in a volume controlled mode now, so you're applying a constant volume, and then you have the change, the corresponding change in pressure that will give then a given driving pressure, right? So in principle, you go up with the PEEP, and then that change in pressure could be higher, lower, or the same as it was before. Then thinking back on that curve, usually the lung will come from a de-recruited level to a recruited level, meaning the compliance of the lung is going to increase from low volumes to higher volumes, and correspondingly from low PEEPs to higher PEEPs. So usually when you increase the PEEP, you expect either that the change in pressure will be the same if one would be going along the same lines of compliance. However, if this PEEP is too low, actually, it could be that you're coming from a lower compliance range to a higher compliance range. So you would have a drop of the delta pressures, which would represent an increase in the compliance of the lungs. Now, you could have the same change in pressure. What would mean, essentially, that you are in the linear phase of that pressure-volume curve. Then we are in that linear stage, which actually would be where we want to be most of the times when we are doing mechanical ventilation of the patient. Conversely, it could be that you would change the PEEP and you apply that same change in volume, and you have actually an increase of the driving pressure. And in that case, that would suggest to you that actually you are getting to the limit of overdistension of the lung, where instead of having, as you would have in the very beginning, coming from a de-recruited to a recruited stage, now you would be going from a recruited stage to an overdistended stage. And then the same change in volume would produce an excessive change in pressure.
Yeah, perfect. So, and just to kind of put some numbers on that, if let's say that my my plateau pressure is 20 and my PEEP is 5, and then I increase my PEEP to 10, if I'm on that linear part of the lung compliance, then my my plateau pressure will go up also by 5. So now I'll have a plateau pressure of 25 and a PEEP of 10, whereas before I had a plateau pressure of 20 and a PEEP of 5. And of course, in both of those scenarios, my driving pressure has not changed. I had 20 minus 5 is 15. Now I have 25 minus 10 is also 15. So that's when I'm on the linear portion and the driving pressure does not change because the plateau pressure and the PEEP go up by the same amount. But if we're, like you said, if PEEP is insufficient, then I might have a plateau pressure of 20 and a PEEP of 5. And then I increase the PEEP to 10, but my plateau pressure only goes up to 22. So now I went from 20 minus 5 is 15 to 22 minus 10 is 12. So my driving pressure went down. And that would suggest to me that this was a good change for the patient because I've now reduced the driving pressure. And then on the far end, like you said, if you're over-distending, you might go from a plateau pressure of 20 and a PEEP of 5. You increase PEEP to 10, and your plateau pressure goes up to 27. So now your driving pressure has gone up.
Exactly.
Great. Perfect. All right. So now let's talk about the other term of transpulmonary pressure. So let me ask you first. People hear the term transpulmonary pressure, and they hear the term transpleural pressure. Are those the same thing?
No. Not at all. So the real term to focus on, I would say, is the term transpulmonary pressure. And even on that, there is a little bit of confusion. But essentially, what we are trying to express there in the concept of transpulmonary pressure is the pressure across the lungs, right? Is the really the effective pressure that distends the lungs. And this is easy to understand if you think, for instance, on a piston, right? I mean, the piston moves not just because of the pressure that's inside the piston, but also the pressure that's outside the piston. That's what makes that move. So in the same terms, in terms of the lungs, what will make the lung distend is not only then the plateau pressure that we're applying or the airway pressure that we're applying to it, but the difference between that pressure that's applied to the airway and the pressure that's outside the lung, which is exactly the pleural pressure that we are talking about. And some people use the term transpleural pressure, et cetera, but it's really the pleural pressure is, it's the pressure that's acting between the two surfaces, the visceral pleura and the parietal pleura. But that is the pressure that we are talking about there. And usually, even to give a little bit of an extended concept, that number is considered to be a constant, but all of you would understand that even that number is not necessarily a constant, because in a standing position, the pleural pressure is more negative in the apical lung regions and more towards positive in the dependent lung regions. And in our patients that are usually supine, that pleural pressure would be more negative in the ventral regions, and it will be more towards positive in the dependent regions. And as a consequence, the transpulmonary pressures will have the reverse trend, so that once you apply your airway pressure or your plateau pressure of, say, 20, for instance, it will generate different transpulmonary pressures in the different lung regions, because the pressure outside will be different from the pressure in the ventral areas will be different from the pressure in the dependent areas. But then back to the general concept is that the fact that the transpulmonary pressure is the pressure that is distending the lungs. So again, back to the example of a plateau pressure of 20 centimeters of water, if you have 20 centimeters of water outside, but we have, because the patient is very heavy, or because you are doing a laparoscopic surgery and the surgeon increased the pressure in the abdomen to, say, 15 centimeters of water or something, and we paralyze the patient, and now we have a flaccid diaphragm that allows all that pressure to transfer into the thoracic space, say that is 15, then your transpulmonary pressure could well be 20 minus 15, meaning 5. So although the plateau pressure would be 20, really the pressure distending the lung in this type of example would be 5. And the pleural pressure, if it equilibrated with this number I talked about, would be 15.
Right. So that's great. That really helps to when people say transpleural, I think you're right. They're referring really to pleural. And so that's the pressure outside. The plateau pressure is the pressure inside. And then the transpulmonary pressure is subtracting those. Right. So, and so I sometimes, will explain to my residents, and tell me if this makes sense, that, you know, the reason it's important to think about the transpulmonary pressure is, if you imagine a balloon, and if you just take a balloon and you blow it and you blow and you blow into it, and you have an unlimited ability to exert pressure, eventually that balloon is going to explode. But if you put that same balloon in a metal box and you blow into it as hard as you can, it's never going to explode, because the pressure pushing in on the balloon from the metal box is going to protect it in a way, right? So you have to take that into account. And in a way, that's like the lung putting 20, 30, 40, however many centimeters of water of pressure into the alveoli. Hard to know what to make of that until you know how much is pressing in from the outside.
Perfect. Yeah, that's a very good concept. That's particularly applicable then exactly to the use of the transpulmonary pressure as a guidance for maximal, say then, inspiratory limits of safety. So that would be exactly so, because you could, like exactly the type of example that I was given, that you have abdominal pressures and you have patients also with, you know, peritoneal hypertension and et cetera, that you will have to apply higher airway pressures for ventilation, and those will not represent a risk to the lungs exactly, because the pressure distending the lung, the difference between one and the other will be much less. Actually, one example I kind of like to give and that people used before was trumpet players. So trumpet players apply a pressure of about 150 centimeters of
really
to their lungs on a regular basis. Yes. And you know, I actually thought that this is going to be a great review article.
Yeah.
I'm going to look for trumpet players and pneumothorax. Yeah. And I didn't find any. I looked for that in PubMed and et cetera to see if I would find some case report and such, and I couldn't. And it's exactly this type of example you're giving. Instead of having a metal box, what you have is a very contracted chest wall and abdomen, generating all that huge pressure from outside the lungs, so that when you measure that 150 centimeters of water in the trachea or in the mouth, you are having also pressures in the hundreds in the pleural space.
Right.
So the delta pressure, the transpulmonary pressure of the trumpet player is going to be a few units of centimeters of water, and he or she is not going to have a pneumothorax. So that is one point. I think another important aspect of this that has been used a lot then for the other extreme of the breathing cycle is the point of end expiration. So we were talking about end inhalation, right, the larger part of the story. But if we think also then, also in terms of the end exhalation, it would be then the situation where, say, you would have your balloon connected by a straw down on a bucket full of water. And now you are trying to insufflate that balloon there. But if you just put 1 centimeter of water, if that balloon would just be in the atmosphere, the balloon would start inflating. But because it's down in the bucket and there is a large height of pressure on top of it, it's not going to insufflate. And you will have to be able to overcome that pressure, and that pressure in this case would be representing exactly the pleural pressure in that region, right, to overcome that pressure in order to insufflate that balloon. So this would be the model of the application of the transpulmonary pressure to determine the PEEP that would be a minimum PEEP to prevent airway collapse at end of exhalation.
That's great. I love that example. All right. So how do we measure transpulmonary pressure?
And there is now a good conversation. But there were different methods experimentally that have been used because, as all of you would expect, it would be a complicated thing, right? Because, like said, the transpulmonary pressure would be measured as the difference between the airway pressure and the pleural pressure. And, well, the airway pressure is pretty easy to measure. You just look at your mechanical ventilator and look at the curve, and you know the airway pressure. Right. And if you want to know the transpulmonary pressure at the end of inhalation, you would use the plateau pressure like we did before for the driving pressure. And if we want to use the transpulmonary pressure for end exhalation, we would use the PEEP or the stabilization pressure at that point. However, how do we measure the pleural pressures at right. those same time points. And this is the tough thing because we are not going to dig a hole in the chest wall to measure pleural pressures of people. So then we would have to start measuring surrogates for clinical applications. In animal experiments, yes, people use direct measurements and did mini thoracotomies and put wafers of transducers or dug holes in the ribs and then put transducers there and etc. But for clinical application, the main resource that has been used is the use of an esophageal balloon. So you have essentially a special catheter that is a catheter that can be placed usually in the lower third of the esophagus and that has openings that are around a cuff that you could think as that of a Swan-Ganz catheter, but much more flaccid with an absolutely negligible mechanical property, compliance, so very, very, very small compliance, and so that you can measure the pressure at that level. And it has been shown by experimental studies and by clinical studies also that pressure is associated with the pleural pressure. So that is the current method to have an estimate of the pleural pressures. There is a still quite significant discussion about how to use this estimate. Some groups would defend the aspect that the changes in the measurement of this esophageal pressure measured with this catheter are associated with the changes of the pleural pressure and just associate changes with changes.
Okay.
Other groups would propose that the absolute measurement would be reliable enough to be used as an absolute estimate of the pleural pressure. There are limitations in both cases, and I think that the final answer to how to use all of this goes way beyond the short conversation. But fact is that one way or the other, the clinical practice that came from the use of these transpulmonary pressures, I think has been pretty convincing to say that it's better to have either one approach or the other than not to have any.
Sure.
And it's better to measure than not to measure.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So let me ask you, when I was training, I was very much taught measure the plateau pressures for someone with ARDS, keep them under 30, even lower is better. Is that now, do we think that driving pressure is a better goal to have in a patient with lung injury to try to reduce driving pressure as much as possible?
So this is... this is the new concept, right? And it was Dr. Marcelo Matos' paper in the New England Journal of Medicine about ARDS patients showing that the benefit of PEEP, for instance, and that benefits of other mechanical ventilation interventions are mediated by the driving pressure more than by the other parameters, and so that the use of the driving pressure as the current best parameter to guide ventilation would be the best approach. The issue is that what are the ranges of this application is what likely has not been that accurately defined, exactly as we were discussing, because driving pressure is a measurement that is derived from the respiratory system, not only from the lungs. So because it's derived from the respiratory system, a value of whatever, 15 centimeters of water, can mean a given change in lung volume in a patient and a very different change in lung volume in another. But on average, in the same patient, a trend towards higher driving pressure in that same patient is something that tends to signalize something that's bad in that patient, and a trend towards lower driving pressure for a similar tidal volumes and et cetera tends to signalize something that's better for that patient. And towards the limit of 30 centimeters of water and such, right? It's it comes to the issue of the transpulmonary pressure we were talking about.
Right.
So then, if in this patient you are mentioning, for instance, this is a obese patient with tremendous amount of penis morbid obesity, for instance, or someone with a terrible peritoneal, intraperitoneal hypertension, and et cetera, that is producing a very large pressure towards the thoracic space. That patient may require PEEPs, for instance, that will result in plateau pressures that go beyond 30 centimeters of water without at all going to transpulmonary pressures that would be at all risky to that lung. And as a consequence, the use of those old limits, now we know that are not to the good of the patient ultimately, because they may well lead you to apply insufficient levels of PEEP, apply insufficient ventilation, when what the patient may need is exactly the opposite.
Right, and so there are times, right? So we think that driving pressure is sometimes, maybe often, a good surrogate for transpulmonary pressure, but not when you have a large pleural pressure, because then you're, as you said, you're going to need a high plateau pressure because you're going to need a high PEEP just to keep that alveoli open. But the transpulmonary pressure is not going to be high because you have the high pleural pressure outside.
Correct. Precisely.
And that also, as you said, that makes it hard to give a number to say, you know, your driving pressure should be X or your plateau pressure should be Y, because it really depends on what the transpulmonary pressure is.
Yes, exactly. And so in these critical cases, and probably you're planning to go there in along the conversation, but I think this is a nice opening for that, is one of those situations when the use of these catheters might be particularly useful, because then we are really practicing individualized medicine, so that we can measure how these patients do, and what is the value that are in this patient. And with all the limitations I talked about before, if the absolute number is precisely the perfect or not, and et cetera, and there's still ongoing studies about this, but it's definitely better than nothing to give some degree of guidance on the value to be used. And what I was going to say is that just stepping a little bit to the side and to give a big perspective, because sometimes I had colleagues come back and say, well, but you're trying to measure everything and become too sophisticated and this and that. And I think that for anesthesiologists, it's very natural when we are thinking about cardiovascular issues to think that, well, we start the case with an EKG, a pulse ox, and a blood pressure cuff. And if the patient has a little bit more of a problem, or if I have any concern, then I go to an A-line. And if I'm a little bit more concerned, this or that, perhaps I'll do a CVP. And if I'm even more concerned, perhaps I'll do a PA catheter, or I put a TEE probe. And this is standard of care for cardiovascular issues. Well, why don't we have some degree of an escalating monitoring and approach also for other organ systems? And I think that that's the way I see actually this monitoring or escalating monitoring for the respiratory system, where the esophageal balloon comes just as a new step when we are starting to have this type of situation. So the other example of some of these challenging situations come, for instance, with robotic surgeries. And we completed recently a study on robotic surgeries in patients that were not obese. And even in those patients, we did see quite a bit of variability of their esophageal pressures, so that when you're using your regular run-of-the-mill, between quotes, protective ventilation, it becomes very clearly that actually that protective ventilation is not protective in some cases, because we are allowing for negative transpulmonary pressures, meaning alveolar collapse, throughout most of the case. So, and, you know, for the regular patient, perhaps that doesn't matter a lot, but when you start having the challenging case of a number of other comorbidities, this can become a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think that it's that you make a great argument about this as a way to, you know, really escalate the monitoring of the lungs in the same way we might escalate the monitoring of the blood pressure or of the any kind of pressure, right? The PA pressure, for a patient with pulmonary hypertension, et cetera. So is it, are there places that, to be honest with you, I'm not even sure that we have esophageal balloons here. I mean, certainly if we have them, I don't know how to get them. Is it something that, are there places that are going, that are starting to have these as an option for patients who you want to monitor the transpulmonary pressure?
It is true that perhaps I'm in a biased place, right? And that's the why. Our respiratory therapists are very educated in this sense, because the leadership of respiratory therapy here has been very active in having this type of interest traditionally. So through respiratory therapy here at the MGH, we can have access to the esophageal balloons. There are actually companies that produce the balloons, and actually that started even selling mechanical ventilators for ICU, then not for the OR, that already have a port that you can feed the connection of the balloon and have measurements and use them and et cetera. Yeah, so this is coming to a shop near you probably. And, and if not, I mean, if one would want to do it in kind of the old-fashioned way, from the point of view of the transduction, a regular hemodynamic transducer can be used. Of course, the resolution is not as good, but the number, if calibrated appropriately, will be okay. The catheter itself, yeah, needs to be available and can be bought in a couple of companies. And sometimes the catheter is a catheter by itself. It's a thin catheter that's placed in awake people, where people want to make monitoring of esophageal pressures awake through the nose. But in our patients, the way I use the most is actually a special, specially fashioned OG tube, essentially, that has a third port, which is exactly the port that stays in the esophagus. So that it's just a regular OG tube. It's just a fancier and a more expensive one, of course. That gives you the third port. And that third port is the one that you could connect. I mean, you can have usually the esophageal pressures will range in a few tenths of centimeters of water up and down, while our usual hemodynamic catheters, right, they go up to 150, 200 millimeters of mercury. So their range is much larger. But, you know, they can be used for at least some estimation of within that range, because then that would be the range sort of a CVP, approximately. Right. So you could still connect to that and have a measurement. Usually there is a specific procedure to position the balloons. And then these, there are papers, and I will attach some of these papers as references that you go, because then when you position, usually for mechanically ventilated people, what you do is you push the catheter or the OG tube, specially fashioned, all the way into the stomach, and then you pull back some, and you want to have it, like said, in the lower third of the esophagus, and then you insufflate the balloon with a couple of millimeters of air, and then you deflate to allow that 1 to 2 millimeters of air would stay inside the balloon, and then you push the stomach gently to make sure that you're not pushing against the catheter, because if you see a positive oscillation when you push the stomach, it's because the catheter probably is in there. It's not where you want. And you take a look at the trace. When it's positioned appropriately, you see a cardiogenic oscillation, because the lower third of the esophagus will be exactly kind of behind the heart. So you will see that oscillation. And if you close the endotracheal tube and you push against the chest, then you have a change in the airway pressure that's essentially equal to the change in the esophageal pressure, because you have a closed airway. And that gives the support, that the additional support, that it is placed in the right position. And then you feel good about doing the measurement.
That's great. All right.
So there are some tricks. Yes.
Yeah. Those are some great tricks. And definitely, if you send me the references you like, we'll put them up with the show notes.
That's great.
So you mentioned sometimes laparoscopic surgery, significant obesity. I imagine pregnancy is another. Are there other times where people may have an elevated pleural pressure that would affect or make their driving pressure not a great surrogate for their transpulmonary pressure?
Yeah, I think you talked about most of the situations, right? So anything that would significantly apply essentially pressure to the thoracic space, either from external pressure on the chest wall or from the abdomen into the diaphragm. So you talked about laparoscopic surgery, robotic surgery, Trendelenburg positions, abdominal hypertension. Those, I think, are the most usual cases there.
Okay, great. And then is there any way to know how much? I mean, obviously, you could measure it if you have the esophageal balloon, but in the absence of being able to measure it, if you know the surgeon is insufflating the abdomen with 20 centimeters of water of pressure, is there any rule of thumb for how much of that is probably transmitted to the pleural pressure?
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually, that needs to, I would say, needs to be studied, to tell you the truth. I think my kind of protective rule of thumb is that almost everything is being transmitted.
Okay.
The reason being is because we paralyze the diaphragm, right? So, and because we paralyze the diaphragm is not anymore going to have any contractile function to separate the pressures below and above it. So as a consequence, it just acts as a flaccid membrane. Of course, it would depend on the mechanical impedances of each one of the sides. And then it becomes a little bit of a complicated problem. On top of the fact that there is the heterogeneity that I was talking about, right? Depending on gravity, and depending on the chest wall, the distribution of the pleural pressures will be different. So it will not be a single value applicable to the whole lung.
Interesting. All right. So if we are measuring it, obviously we only get a number. We get the number in the esophagus,
right.
And then that is an approximation, but it may vary across the length of the pleura.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, that's a good one because that number is about when people did the measurements in experiments and in cadavers, it's about where the esophagus is, meaning a third from the dorsal area of the lungs. So that measurement that we do, generally, it would correspond to the pleural pressure at the level of the esophagus, meaning at about the level of a third from the dorsal area of the lung, a third of the height, of the total height. And if you would think, though, this is kind of where atelectasis happens,
right?
It's the dorsal part of the lung. So actually, it so happens that because of how it's measured and because of where the esophagus is, it actually is positioned in a way to be advantageous to tell us kind of where atelectasis is happening and then to guide somewhat the PEEP to be used.
Great. That's perfect. All right. Marcos, this has been fantastic. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you think is really important to say to our listeners before we end?
Well, I would only reemphasize what I was talking about, that while all the principles of protective ventilation that have been discussing to date in terms of limitation of tidal volumes, maintaining some degree of lung expansion is relevant, there are all these types of challenging situations we've been talking about when we start kind of losing a good ground and a good objective view of what's exactly happening with the lungs, and that in those cases, it might well be relevant to consider use of an esophageal balloon, for instance, to be more specific in the management of patients, and also that for the driving pressure, which is something that's available every day, that all the clinicians would start take a look on a more regular basis, see how it changes during the case, and perhaps if it starts to change too much, to start considering, well, why is that happening and why. There is one conceptual aspect that we didn't talk about that perhaps we should before we finish, because it's very, I think, relevant from the concept of why physiologically driving pressure should be important. Because one could say, well, okay, well, this is the plateau minus the PEEP, so what, right? It's kind of, yeah. So the physiological concept behind the story that makes it relevant is if you remember the equation of the compliance of the lungs, which is the compliance of the lungs equals the change in volume, so say the tidal volume, divided by the corresponding change in pressure. That change in pressure is exactly the driving pressure. Now, if you put the driving pressure to one side of the equal sign and bring the compliance to the other side of the equal sign, if you guys can follow me in the conversation, it will be that the driving pressure is equal to the tidal volume divided by the compliance. Now, if you think that tidal volume is a changing volume, and that the compliance of the respiratory system and of the lungs in some way is a measure of the amount of alveolar units that are open, meaning if someone has a high compliance, a lot of alveolar units are open. If the patient has a low compliance, less alveolar units are open. For a first approximation, I know that there are several other complications for this, but as a first approximation, then that ratio of tidal volume by a compliance, which is the driving pressure, is a ratio between a change in volume and an initial available volume that is being distended by that tidal volume. Well, this concept of changing volume divided by an initial volume is so-called volumetric strain. And a number of other studies, including studies from our lab, have shown the relevance of this volumetric strain as ultimately the determinant of lung injury by mechanical ventilation. So driving pressure is actually, say, a poor man's global volumetric strain measure of your patient. And then it becomes kind of an entry parameter, I think, if you see it, if you see it this way. So if you think this way, at least to start, you can see why it would be. And then we talked about the driving pressure information in ARDS patients. But then our own group, together with Dr. Matthias Eichermann and Karin Lada, who is now in Toronto and et cetera, we've shown that in patients undergoing non-cardiothoracic surgery, that the driving pressure is the main determinant of postoperative pulmonary complications, a study in more than 60,000 patients. So it does show, and then Dr. Ari Serpanetto also had a publication with the group in Europe and et cetera and in other places that confirmed this type of results. So showing that actually it is kind of interesting that this parameter that in principle could be kind of simplorious, right? Okay, plateau minus peep, whatever, that it starts showing that it really seems to have some meaningful message in several clinical settings, so not only in ARDS, but actually in regular mechanically ventilated non-cardiothoracic patients. So just to emphasize these two points.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Thanks for sharing that. All right, so now is the part of the show where we make random recommendations, something that you would recommend to our listeners as they are going about their weekend and thinking about how they could entertain themselves. Do you have anything, Marcos, that you'd like to share?
Sure. It's going to be sunny and somewhat windy in New England this weekend. So either if you like some water sports, there is some windsurfing and kite surfing to be done either in Revere Beach or down the Cape. Nice. Or even if you want to watch, these are beautiful places just to go and appreciate the environment.
That is awesome. Thank you so much for recommending that. My random recommendation is going to have to do with the amazing History of Anesthesia trip that we just did. We take our CA2s every year to Boston. We have just incredible experiences there. We're very lucky to be hosted by some of the fantastic faculty who have taken a real interest in the history of anesthesia. And we do a tour around Boston and Mount Auburn Cemetery and just some of the real sites where some of the key figures in the history of anesthesia are buried. And we go to the Ether Dome. We just learn a ton and have a great, great time every year. We're very lucky to get to do that. I'm very appreciative of our hosts there in Boston. And I would say that anybody who can get to Boston at any point, just go around. You can find a lot of this on the internet. Look up the history of anesthesia, some of the key people and places in and around Boston. and check it out. Even if you do it on your own without some of the incredible faculty there who help us out, I still think you'll get a lot out of it. And it's a really rich experience. I think it really is able to bring home and emphasize some of the rich history of what we do every day. I think it's easy to get caught up in the, you know, daily pressure and the daily tasks, but to forget that we're part of this larger story, and it's really fascinating. So my recommendation is check out The History of Anesthesia in and Around Boston, Massachusetts. And I'm very excited that we have a listener recommendation today, a random recommendation from the one and only Dr. Alex Stone, who was, I'm proud to say, a medical student here at Johns Hopkins, is now a resident at the Brigham, and he recommends an Instagram feed called Anesthesia History. So check out Anesthesia History on Instagram, and you'll see some really interesting posts that will complement a lot of the tour you're going to do when you go to Boston and check that out. So thank you to Alex Stone for sending in a random recommendation. Remember, everyone out there, send them in. You can email them to acrac@acrac.com. You can tweet them at me, at Jay Wolpaw, or at Rack Podcast, and we will sift through them and put some of them on the air. All right, Marcos, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks a lot, Jed. This was great.
All right. That was fantastic. I hope you enjoyed it. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment and others can learn from what you have to say. Let us know what you are doing at your place. Are you using driving pressure or are you still using plateau pressure, and how are you using it? You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Jay Wolpaw. And of course, the podcast is at ACRAC Podcast. You can also join the Facebook group, the ACRAC Facebook group, and take part in the conversation there. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you're interested in supporting the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. Of course, you can also make a donation anytime at paypal.me/ACRAC. Thank you so much to those who are already patrons and have already made donations. A huge thank you to Brian Park for making the outline for some of the shows. And, of course, to our ACRAC intern, Kimia Cash Cooley. And a big thank you, as always, to the man responsible for our original ACRAC music. That's Dr. Dennis Quo. Check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that's it for today. Thanks so much for listening. For Dr. Vidal Mello and the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
If you're looking for legit ways to make extra money, you've got to check out The Side Hustle Show. With hundreds of actionable episodes to choose from, you'll learn what's working now from real people making real money, like the Utah mom who built a six-figure business playing video games, or the guy earning $3,000 a month renting out mobility scooters. Online or offline, from Amazon to your own hometown, from YouTube to vending machines, The Side Hustle Show has you and your wallet covered. Subscribe to The Side Hustle Show wherever you're listening to this podcast and increase your earning power today.